You were born in Washington, huh?
Yes.
Were you born in the city proper?
Yes, Chevy Chase.
It's not really Washington, then.
I was born in the city proper, and when I was 5 years old, the family moved to Chevy Chase, but it's Chevy Chase, Washington, which really is the city of Washington.
Was it?
Yeah,
it?
Technically.
It is.
Not to be confused with Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is quite a different region.
Oh, is
and
that
it's
right?
often said, I read constantly biographical notes about myself saying that I was born and raised in Chevy Chase, Maryland. It's simply untrue. Other side of the tracks.
Uh-huh. What was it like growing up in Chevy Chase, Washington?
Well, when I grew up there, it was a curious street because a lot of the lots weren't sold, and the house that my parents moved into was right across from a tributary to Rock Creek Park. So really it was a very rural environment, and yet 5 minutes away was Connecticut Avenue, which is one of the main streets of Washington. And so you had fast accessibility to the city and the environment of a city, in a way, the minute you got a few minutes away from the house itself. But it was as though I grew up in the country in some ways. There were, you know, bunnies hopping around, and I could get a new pet turtle anytime I went out the back door, and I climbed trees. So it wasn't as though I always had a very urban upbringing alone.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
My mother is a great reader. And I wouldn't say that my father reads a great deal. He reads about things that interest him. But I was read to as a child a lot, and books were always around.
Did you do any fledgling writing as a child?
I did a bit, but I don't think that it ever seemed clear-cut that that would be directly related to what I'd do with the rest of my life. It probably was clear-cut that I would have nothing to do with mathematics. I never could add two and two.
Thank God we have calculators today.
I'm very grateful for them.
I wonder how we survived. I remember when I got my first calculator, which was about 10 years ago, and it was $50 for one of these little tiny things that now they give away at banks.
Yeah.
And I wonder, since I could never add two and two either, I just wonder how I got along all those years stupidly as I... Now I feel really in charge of my... I can almost always balance my checking account. Well, almost, you know, about every 3 months it goes awry, and I just forget about it.
If you can find where you put the calculator.
That's, well, you know, but they're so cheap, you have them everywhere. I mean, if you lose one, I think I carry one in my wallet, and I have another one in my attaché case, and I have one built into my computer, and then I have a couple around. They're everywhere.
So yeah.
And they only cost a couple of bucks.
Yeah.
You went to American University?
Yes.
What did you study?
I started out studying journalism, and then I was dating a man who told me that that really wasn't very cool and that I should think about literature and I should think about being an artist. And I was 19 years old and agreed with him, and I switched over and finally graduated as an English major.
Smart move. For someone who wants to write, journalism is the kiss of death.
What I did like about it, and I still like about it, though, is the fun part of it to me. Maybe it wouldn't have been fun if I had continued with that as my career, but I love to try to fit headlines and get out the cropping wheel and do the somewhat mechanical aspects of it.
Buy a computer. Get a Macintosh. Buy a program called McPublisher and publish your own newsletter.
You sound like the teachers who used to urge me to study my math book. Futilely.
Well, there, I think there is a problem with journalism. I don't think it lends well with creative writing for some reason. Even though journalists write every day, very seldom do you find journalists who are also literarily involved. Well, there are exceptions. William Kennedy is an exception, and another fellow Washingtonian of yours, William McPherson, wrote a wonderful novel about 2 years ago called Testing the Current.
Yes, I read it.
And he's a journalist. There are occasional journalists who write fiction. Jimmy Breslin has written a couple of novels. But by and large, I think that you, your route was the best. Studying English was the best because I think it gave you a comprehension of literature, what people are saying in a creative way. This doesn't happen with journalism.
No, that in particular doesn't happen with journalism very much. That's true.
What happened after college?
After American University, I went to the University of Connecticut, and I got an MA there. And then I went through the coursework in the PhD program, but during the course of doing that, I not only didn't distinguish myself as a graduate student, but did start writing. And it became more than a hobby, I think, around 1970, 71, 72. And finally, I started sending out some of my stories, and eventually they were accepted. And I quit short of the PhD because, for one thing, there were no jobs for academics had I even finished. So it was very lucky that my hobby snowballed and I managed to get a job initially as a creative writer. And that was at the University of Virginia in 1975.
As a teacher?
Yes.
How far away were you from the PhD?
There were five exams, and I had taken three of them, and I never wrote a dissertation.
Any chance you'll revive your effort?
No, no chance at all. I'm deeply grateful that I was pulled out of the slush pile with the New Yorker. It's much more pleasing to me to do this than to do that.
Well, why can't you have the Ph.D. and still write?
It was hard for me because I don't have a good mind as an academic. The way in which you were asked to talk about literature in graduate school was never a vocabulary that I could pick up very easily. And it wasn't really fun. It wasn't the sort of fun that I have reading unofficially now. And there just was no reason to pursue that because I would not need a Ph.D. to teach writing. And as I say, in those days, and even now, it remains a big problem for people in my area, which was modern and contemporary American literature, to find a job. There are just not many jobs. So I can't see at this point what good the degree would do me.
So writing started as a hobby.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so the New Yorker picked you out of a slush pile.
A term that I didn't even know in those days. In fact, a friend who liked the stories and who gave me a lot of help early on, J.D. O'Hara, who was a professor at the University of Connecticut, used to put stamps on them and send them to magazines, sometimes without even telling me. Sometimes the first thing I saw was a rejection saying, "Dear Miss Beattie, we are herewith, forthwith, forever with, in closing," etc.
It seems to me that writers have to have a fairly tough hide. You mentioned the rejection slip you have. Is this feeling of rejection difficult, or do you just say, look, it's been rejected, I'm just going to go on and do something else?
It depends if you get me on a good day or on a bad day. It's not easy. It doesn't get any easier either. On the other hand, in those days anyway, I was rather prolific. And so even though in terms of quantity, the New Yorker rejected a great deal before they published me, they rejected about 20 stories before they finally published me. I had written about 20 stories over the period of a year or a year and a half. So in terms of the time, you know, of my life, it wasn't as though for 10 straight years I had no luck. It was that relatively soon, I initially was pulled out of the slush pile, and then relatively soon after that, they did publish something. So it was maybe easier for me to take than it is for some people to take who would only write three or four stories a year and who would then spend 5 or 6 years, possibly, before they got something accepted.
So your first book was a collection of the stories that had appeared primarily in the New Yorker, is that correct?
Distortions and Chilly Scenes of Winter were published simultaneously in 1976.
Chilly Scenes, that was the novel, though?
Yes.
Oh, that's unusual.
It is unusual.
Huh. How'd that come about?
I had both. I did write the stories over a period of several years that are in Distortions, the first book. And during that time, I was also working on Chilly Scenes of Winter. And they just went off to a publisher coincidentally at the same time. I think actually it was a very good marketing strategy of Doubleday's to bring them out on the same day. It did seem to capture the reviewer's attention in a way. It is unusual to do that.
What was it like? What was the feeling when you saw your book for the first time, both of them, I guess, for the first time? You were able to pick them up or pick it up and look at, turn the pages, see your name on it. What feeling was that like?
Oh, it's hard to sound as enthusiastic now as I was then, but it was, of course, an incredible feeling. I was living in a rented house outside of Charlottesville. I was living in Cobham, Virginia, and the UPS truck came and turned into the mile-long driveway and dropped a carton off at the front door. And I carried the thing in and undid it and looked and just stood there shaking my head. It just seemed incredible. It still seems, 6 books later, it still seems incredible.
The excitement hasn't worn off when the new one comes off the press.
No, in some ways it always seems just as unreal to me. Every time I catch sight of it in a bookstore or every time I look at it on my own shelf, it still seems to me absolutely mysterious that it could have gotten done.
When you look back at some of your earlier work, or even Love Always, which I assume you wrote at least a minimum of a year and a half, 2 years ago, I would assume it took that long by the time it actually has come out. And you look back at some of the things you wrote earlier, does it feel that you are the writer, or do you find yourself divorced as if somebody else has actually put those words onto paper?
No, I do feel like I'm still the writer of those things, but I give a lot of readings, and I don't really reread my own material. I don't sit around the living room, rereading Distortions to see what I thought 12 years ago or anything like that. But I tend to read from the more recent material simply because that's obviously what's most at hand and what interests me most. So I don't really look at the older stuff very much. I'm sure there are a lot of things that I've forgotten or that certainly wouldn't impress me very much any longer if I looked at it.
Do you mind mine earlier material for stories that you can pursue or themes that you can pursue? Or when you write something, is it just, it's gone, you go on to something else?
I don't save anything. I don't save notes. I don't save rough drafts of things that don't finally get typed up and or printed somewhere. And so, no, I don't really go back and recycle material in any way. I don't think I've ever done that.
Do you ever see this book? I think it's called The Notebooks of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that writer threw away anything. I think you have to be a dyed-in-the-wool Fitzgerald fan to even buy the book. But I looked through it, and they're just little bits. Sometimes they were just sentences and unconnected
thoughts. Saw a tree blowing in breeze today, !
Yeah, I just...
In a way, it's wonderfully pedantic. You know, somebody who could be as good as he was in The Great Gatsby would have a thought as pedantic as, you know, new leaves on tree, springtime, !
But if I did something like that, I could never find it. I mean, they would just be in bits and pieces of paper in a shopping bag, and I couldn't find it anyway.
Years ago, I once had a temper tantrum, and I tore a story to shreds and threw it out. And it was actually rescued from me by the man that I was married to at the time. And he scotch-taped it back together very carefully. And I did do another draft of it then and send it off, and it was published in The New Yorker. It's a story called Snake Shoes that I believe is in Distortions, the first book.
Why did you have a temper tantrum?
It's a frustrating thing to be a writer in a way. I think, of course, many professions are terribly frustrating. I don't mean to, you know, call up special pleading for writers or anything, but it is done so much in solitude as opposed to other things. I mean, even an actor is not usually on stage alone giving a monologue. You usually have other players there, or most people have jobs in which they have colleagues and they have some sounding board for their ideas. But really, I think with writers, it's between your brain and the pen, or the keyboard, as it would be today. And that's difficult. I mean, I think you build up a lot of tension not having anyone at hand that you can really consult, or not having anybody who can possibly be a collaborator. You can have somebody who can be a good editor and somebody who can encourage you, but you really can't say, hey, what do you think about this, in the middle of writing a description of a lake.
In Love Always, you have a huge assortment of characters all coming together in one form or another in this small town in Vermont. And yet it's not, it doesn't seem to me to be a heavily plotted novel, but a series of interactions among the people. How did you approach a novel like that? Now, I can see a mystery novel usually has a plot and a subplot, and all the threads, if it's well done, are tied up at the end. But in more serious literature, this isn't frequently done. And I'm just wondering how a writer of the type you are approaches something as elusive as this sort of work.
When I write anything, including novels, I just feel my way in. And it's quite mysterious to me sometimes that a dog named St. Francis appears and then goes around the neighborhood, you know, killing birds and cats or something like that. I think that's the fun of writing to me. Not knowing what's going to happen. By the way, if nothing happens, if in effect there's a dog and the dog, you know, sleeps for several hours, and that's the best thing I can think of, nothing gets written. So I'm always worried when I begin a novel that I'll only manage 5 pages or 10 pages or whatever. And I have set out to write novels and simply drawn a blank and they've never been written. And more often I've set out to write stories and I've drawn a blank and nothing has happened. Because, as I say, if the material doesn't overwhelm me in some way, I'm incapable of forcing a shape onto it.
Well, in Love Always, you have a large cast of characters. Did you start with that cast of characters, or did you start small and then the characters gradually met one another?
I didn't start with that large cast of characters, no. And, in fact, the first chapter, which is a party scene in which you meet lots of characters, used to be something like Chapter 5. I think the book started out initially with the focus on Lucy Spencer and the fact of her niece's arrival in Vermont, and that was what I was going to write about. But somehow Lucy got a job, and there were a lot of colleagues with the job, and quite a bunch of paraphernalia came with Nicole, and it took off from there, much to my surprise.
I particularly liked your characterization. They weren't in the book too much, but they were the two police officers who came across the automobile in the woods, and I thought that was well done. I guess they appeared a second time in the antique shop, gift shop, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was. But I liked, that was very cleverly done, I thought. When When you write a book like Love Always, are you a constant reviser, or do you revise as you go, or how do you approach this?
I do both. I do revise as I go. What I usually do when I'm working on a novel is work pretty feverishly, work for a lot of hours on consecutive days for a long time to do it. And mostly I do this at night. I start writing in the late afternoon or early evening and write until 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, whatever it might be. And then after I sleep for a while, I get up and look at what I've written and line edit that, but really don't obsess about it very much. Line edit it almost to keep it firmly in mind so that I know what my starting point is when I begin writing again. And then at the end, of course, I do a large sort of edit of the whole thing. In this case, as I say, I shuffled chapters. I, in fact, added that chapter in the lingerie shop where all the women encounter each other, because I'd realized that I'd set up the possibility that they would meet, but I'd never actually had it happen. I never had it materialized, so I added that. And there's a lot of shuffling involved. It tends to be more getting things in the right order and omitting things for me rather than putting things in. It's very rare that I do what I did there and have to write a chapter in which the characters do physically bump into each other.
How important is it to have editorial input, or the person who edited the book? Do you work closely with an editor?
Yes, I do, and I've been very lucky. Rob Cowley at Random House was my editor for the last four books, and we have a wonderful relationship. I don't think I possibly could have had a better editor than Rob. He's also a great diplomat as far as I'm concerned. He knows just how to handle me. I don't think he ever phrases anything as, he doesn't insist on anything. He plants a question, the don't you think approach, which of course is perfect because it just tortures me. I stay up all night thinking, don't I think? And in the morning I think I'm sure exactly what he meant me to think by the time morning rolls around. But also I think he has a wonderful sense of humor, and you know, we just have such rapport that it's nice to know when you are in isolation that still there's somebody there rooting for you, and I've always known that that was true with Rob.
Are you you are still teaching, is that correct?
No, I haven't taught for a long time. I taught in 1982 at the University of Virginia for one semester, but that was the last real teaching I've done.
You mean all you've done is write books?
All I've done is write books. Well, I'm tired.
You can't find an honest way to make a living? You have to write books?
Yeah, that's the truth.
How do you have your work area set up? What kind of house do you work out of?
To tell you the truth, at the moment, until 4 days ago, when I at least moved my possessions into the house that I bought, which is being renovated, I was typing on a table with three legs. One had been broken off and moving, and I had book cartons propping up the other side of the desk. My typewriter was in the repair shop, and I had a huge electronic machine that I had almost no idea how to type on. And it was all shoved up in a tiny alcove looking out over the Blue Ridge Mountains, which I was much more inclined to study than the page in front of me. So sometimes in the most makeshift way is exactly how I write. But generally the routine is that I sit down sanely in some sort of office area and start in, and I do compose at the typewriter.
You are in the Charlottesville, Virginia area. You've lived in Massachusetts and Connecticut and I guess in New York City as well. Do you miss this part of the country, or is this rural life down there the way it's going to be for a while?
I guess what I have to say, having moved this many times, is that nothing ever entirely satisfies me, and I'm very grateful that I have the mobility that I have. When I'm in the city, I often miss the country, and when I'm in the country, I often miss the city, and I've never found the perfect place to live. But I think Charlottesville is a very good place as a home base, because I really do know and like the city. I do think it's beautiful. I do think it's a very livable place. And I can get back to New York and do all the time, just on a moment's notice, which is very nice.
This having the university there gives you an academic focus as well, doesn't it?
Coincidentally, I think the university gets awfully good people, and so I really like the social life in Charlottesville. But I don't have the sense just that I'm in a university community. It's as different a place as, for instance, Berkeley doesn't seem to me just like a university place, even though there is a large segment there. The same with Charlottesville.
Would you consider teaching again? Do you wait to another school for a semester or two semesters, or is that all behind you?
I really try to resist the temptation to do it because in some ways it's very gratifying. I mean, it does please me when I'm good at it, but it takes a terrible toll, too. I find it very difficult to teach and to expend a lot of energy trying to fix somebody else's work and really trying to put yourself in a number of different students' minds to see how you can help them, and then having the in-class time and the out-class time, and inevitably it's a personal thing, and so you end up functioning as an armchair psychiatrist for them and every other thing. It's not a job that is clearly defined, finally. And it really does just sap my energy to an extent that I think it's better if I'm able to do it, if I allow myself the time to write rather than giving a lot of that energy away.
What you're saying is I don't want to teach anymore.
I really am in conflict about it. I have no plans to teach, and it's not a high priority item that I teach, but I'm sure that I will do it again because I do like some of the bonuses. And as I say, writing is really a solitary thing, and I even like the sense of being able to go in and toss around ideas with a dozen other people once a week around a seminar table. That's fun for me. That's not something I usually get to do. In my position, what I do is I'm the judge of a contest. Well, that means that I sit alone in the living room and, as I did, you know, within the last couple of weeks, read 144 short stories. What do you say? I'm probably the world's worst dinner guest. I mean, when I show up and I say, you should have seen entry number 56, in which, you know, my friends just sort of glaze, their eyes just sort of glaze over.
Yeah, when I was in college, I took creative writing, and I was a journalist, but I took creative writing anyway because it was an interest of mine. But the damage I would inflict on my professor was a novelist named Hollis Summers, and I guess he's still teaching to a degree. But the stuff I used to give him, once in a while I would come up with a nice story, but when I think of those stupid adolescent stories based on college people and their interests and so forth, and now, I'm embarrassed as I look back, and yet he was a very kind man. He would write things in my stories. If he didn't like it, he wouldn't say I don't like it or this is wrong or something. He would write something like I can't hear. But if he liked it, he would say, this pleases me. So he was a very nice man.
Yes,
I went back last year, college campus, and he didn't remember me because I had him in 1955, so he wouldn't have remembered me, thank God. But I remembered him, of course, and I had dinner with him, and it was wonderful. He sent me, he has a new book of short stories out, published by Johns Hopkins, I think, and he sent me a copy of that. It was nice that I could look back at a college professor I had 30 years ago and remember him with such warmth and feeling, because if you have taught, but you may not have known it, because you're so busy doing the daily grind of teaching. But what you have done for these kids is extremely influential, and they're going to remember you. Either they may hate you or they may love you, but they're going to remember.
Yes, that part is very true.
And they're going to come back 30 years later and maybe take you to dinner.
All right, I'll go.
And VD, I want to ask you, do you always have a project going, or do you get between things where you can kind of catch up and rest?
I don't always have an official project going. In fact, what I like to do, if possible, is to allow myself the time to sit around and hope that inspiration will strike. What I think of myself as primarily is a short story writer, and that's what certainly brings me the most pleasure of any kind of writing that I do. And so I like to allow the time for that. And I have been writing a lot of stories lately. I have enough for a new collection now, by now. And I am involved in one other project. I'm going to be writing a nonfiction book for Abrams about Alex Katz, the painter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm starting to do some research for that. And I think that's very exciting. I love to be a journalist because it's playing hooky.
Don't do it. Don't be a journalist. It'll ruin you for life. Ann Beattie, thank you very much. It was
an
outgoing person, easy to talk to. I was delighted that you came in and spent this half hour with me.
Thank you.